All right, 1 Samuel chapter 24 this evening. At this point in our study, Saul sits as a usurper on the throne of Israel. David, we know, is supposed to be the king, but Saul is not willing to step down. He's still fighting for that position. As we've covered before, Saul and David really are a type for Satan and Jesus. They really do reflect a type for something that took place on a much grander scale. In fact, something that we are in the middle of right now. And that is that Jesus is the rightful king of the kingdoms of this world. He has purchased that back. He's redeemed that. And yet Satan remains as the god of this age, the ruler of this world, in much the same way as Saul did at this time, as a usurper that was unwilling to step down. Now, both would be removed. Saul was removed, and Satan will be removed. The Lord is going to come back and establish his kingdom on the earth. And Jesus is going to get the crown. Saul is going to lose the crown. David is going to get the crown. It's a nice little type that we can follow and learn a lot about. But in the meantime, for Saul, he has become obsessed with eliminating his competition for the throne. He is obsessed with killing David. I don't know if you realize, even if you've been here for all these studies, just how many times he's tried to kill David already. Like, it's absurd. He tried to impale David with a spear 3 times. That did not work. None of those occasions. He tried to get David killed in battles too numerous to even count. I like just didn't even have the time to go back and count how many times that he technically tried to do that. But all of those attempts failed. He tried to get David killed by sending him on a wild foreskin chase. That didn't work either. He sent men to David's home to capture him there in his home with his wife and bring David back for execution. That did not work. He sent 3 different groups of men to Ramah to capture David as he was staying with Samuel there, hiding for his life, in order to bring him back for execution. And that did not work either. And in chapter 20, Saul is still being Saul. He's still trying to do the same thing. He's still trying to figure out ways that he can get David killed. But the primary focus of chapter 20 really isn't on that, like Saul trying to kill David. Yes, he's working on it, but the chapter's not really about that. The primary focus of chapter 20 is all about convincing Jonathan that his dad is actually, yes, still trying to kill David. We found out in the last chapter that Jonathan wanted to believe the best about his father. And in chapter 19, on up until verse 6, Jonathan tried to talk Saul down from killing David. In verse 6, Saul made a vow. He said, okay, you know, I won't. You're right. You're right about this. David actually didn't do anything wrong. I vow to you. I take an oath. I won't kill David. And Jonathan believes that that's where Saul still is mentally, that he is still honoring his promise and that he's not going to attempt to kill David any longer. He believes that Saul is still sticking to his word. So in this chapter, Jonathan needs convinced of the truth that his dad is still hell-bent on killing David. And if he doesn't realize that, then Jonathan, if he's not careful, he's going to end up getting David killed himself. Of course, speaking humanly. In human terms there. In a very unexpected move from David, who was running for his life, he now decides that after hiding out in Naoth there in Ramah, to make a trip back into the danger zone there in Gibeah, in the tribe of Benjamin, where Saul and his royal palace was set up, to visit his friend Jonathan. He wants to convince Jonathan. Now, if it were any of us, I think we'd probably say, who cares about Jonathan? Friends come and go. C'est la vie. I can find me some new friends, friends that don't live close to Saul. But that just was not good enough for David. He would not let this friendship go. So he wants to speak to Jonathan. He wants to convince him that Saul is still trying to kill him, David. And he wants to maintain that friendship with Jonathan through all of it, regardless of what happens. And it is a lot to risk just for the sake of a friendship. And though I didn't really map that out as one of our major lessons for this chapter, maybe we should give that some consideration. It is for sure a lesson from this chapter, the value of friendship, the value of godly friendship, to be more pointed. And not just the lesson from this chapter, but really the lesson that comes from the story of David and Jonathan's friendship. That's one of the things that we learn, the value of friendship, and that it is worth the risk. It's worth doing whatever it takes to keep that relationship healthy. So let's begin reading in verse 1, see how all of this shakes out for the chapter. Verse 1, then David fled from Naoth in Ramah. So that's where he and Samuel were hiding out from Saul. And came back to Saul's royal residence there in Gibeah. And came and said before Jonathan, what have I done? What is my guilt? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? Verse 2. And he, Jonathan, said to him, David, far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so. So if my dad was really trying to still kill you, David, I would know about it. I'm his son. He tells me everything. Again, Jonathan had talked Saul down in chapter 19, verse 6. Saul swore that oath to Jonathan that he would no longer pursue to take the life of David. But since that time, since chapter 19, verse 6, when Saul gave his oath, Saul has actually made 5 attempts on the life of David since swearing that oath. And now we know that Saul was very careful after breaking that oath to keep Jonathan out of that loop, to make sure that Jonathan didn't know any of his attempts on David's life, to try to keep that from Jonathan and do that behind Jonathan's back. So Jonathan is having a very difficult time believing that his father has broken the vow that he made to him. My main beef here would be with Michal, because she knew that their father was still trying to kill David. She knew that so well that she had to help him escape out the window because she knew he was going to be killed that night. And I'm just wondering, why didn't Jonathan talk to his sister Michal? Why didn't Michal go to Jonathan and let Jonathan know that? Probably the two of them should have had a conversation. See, sometimes it's just not good to keep stuff from other people, right? Important stuff, have a conversation. You might not always be saving people's lives, but those conversations are important. If you know important stuff, then talk to people. Verse 3, but David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he thinks, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. If I have just one slip up, Saul is going to end up killing me. And David hit the nail on the head here. Saul knows how much Jonathan likes David. Saul knows that he made a vow to specifically Jonathan, that he wouldn't break, that he wouldn't kill David. So if Jonathan finds out that his father broke that vow, yes, he's going to be grieved. He's going to be really upset. So naturally then Saul has to keep it from Jonathan that he has changed his mind yet again. I will kill David. I won't kill David. I will kill David. I won't kill David. He has made up his mind yet again that yes, he is planning to kill David. Verse 4, then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. And what he means by that is, okay, David, we disagree here. I think my father's telling the truth. I don't think he's still out to kill you. You think he's still out to kill you. So whatever you need me to do to test my father and to prove it to you that he's moved on and that you're safe, whatever I need to do, you let me know and we'll do that. We'll set up a test for my dad and I'll prove it to you. My dad's no longer angry at you. He's no longer trying to kill you. Verse 5. David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king." So the new moon, or the feast of the new moon, that was considered a monthly Jewish holiday or holy day. Holiday, yeah. That too, depending on how you pronounce it, I guess. It was commanded by the law of Moses in both the books of Exodus and Numbers. And it was a two-day feast. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, if it was a month that was 29 days, it was a one-day feast. If it was a month that was 30 days, then it was a two-day feast. Don't quote me on that. But it was a two-day feast. Ordinarily, what they would do is they would have a feast dinner on the night of the 30th. That was the, you know, phasing out of the old moon. And then they would have another feast night the following day, the evening of the first of the month, which was the new moon. So two feast days in a row, and it's an important celebration. So David knows that he is expected to attend that feast. But in light of recent events, you know, Saul trying to kill him a couple more times, he figures, probably best if I don't show up. Probably best if I just go ahead and skip this holiday. And he now wants to use his absence from those two feast days as the test that he'll give to Jonathan to test his father and kind of feel out his father and see where he is on the issue. See who's right. Does Saul still want to kill David or not? So David says this, "But let me go." And I think he's saying that because he's put Jonathan in a difficult position here now. Jonathan has stumbled upon David. It would now be Jonathan's responsibility to make sure that David attends this feast. And if he's not going to attend there, then he's going to have a pretty good answer for his father, the king. So he truly has to ask Jonathan's permission. "Jonathan, but let me go, that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening." So the third day, that would be the day after this two-day feast. So David is wanting to sit the whole thing out. Once it's all over on the following day, he's going to plan to have a little meeting with Jonathan. Verse 6, "If your father misses me at all," that is, if he notices that I'm not there at those two feast days, "then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan." And that was a lie. David is asking Jonathan to tell a lie to his father. David has no intention of going back to Bethlehem for these two or three days. He's not going to do that. I'm pretty sure he's making this whole thing up. I don't think there is even this like special holiday for the family of David. For sure, he's not going back to Bethlehem. He's going to be camping out right there in the field, waiting for Saul to be tested and waiting to get word back. So he is most certainly lying here. Believe me, I've tried to find a way where David wasn't lying here. He is definitely lying here. And it actually won't be the last time that David lies in order to get himself out of trouble. He's going to do it in the very next chapter. We're going to study it next week. He's going to lie to Ahimelech, the priest, so that he can get bread for food. And David does not get a pass when he does stuff like this. When David lies, when David sins, we don't give him a pass just because, well, David's the man. No, David may be the man, but you know, David was an imperfect man, just like you and I are imperfect. And don't forget, these are the early days for David. So these are character building days. These are faith building days for David. Now, I know it wouldn't seem like after the Goliath thing that David, of all people, would need his faith built up. But truly, that's exactly what we're seeing in this chapter. When you lie to bail yourself out, that is a proof of doubt. That is an absence of faith that the Lord can take care of you. Yes, this absolutely does prove to us that David has a hitch in his faith here because he's no different from anyone else. You know how this goes. You've been there a million times. One day you ace a gigantic test. And then the next day, or a couple days later, or a few weeks later, You face a much smaller test, and it just absolutely crushes you. You just absolutely blow it. Have you ever been there? Like, how could I succeed in something that was so trying and then fail miserably in something that should have been so easy for me? So David is the same way here. He's faced the 9 foot 9 tall Goliath. He had no hitches in his faith there. He's now facing a guy that's probably somewhere around 3 feet shorter than that guy, probably around 300 or 400 pounds lighter than that guy. And yet he's totally freaking out. His faith is shaking here, and he tells a lie to try to save himself. Anytime that we lie in order to try to save ourselves, that is a conscious decision to take the matter out of God's hands and keep it in our own hands. And that might not sound like a big deal, but it really is. First of all, you've committed the sin of lying. And then second of all, when you do that, when you lie and take the situation out of the Lord's hands, you absolutely ruin the chance that God would step in that situation, do something miraculous to deliver you and help you because you trusted him, and then leave you with a tremendous testimony once that difficult situation is over. You see how that would work? When we are in the corner, when our backs are against the wall and we feel like the only recourse is to either lie or go down with the ship, well, we should choose to go down with the ship. We should choose to put our faith in the Lord, tell the truth, and just say, all right, Lord, if this is it, if this is the day I come toppling down, my reputation, my life, if this is the day that it all ends, so be it. I'm not going to lie to save myself. It's moments like that where the Lord will step in. We've been talking about this, right? If you can duck to save yourself, then duck. If you can climb out the window to save yourself, then climb out the window. If you can lie to save yourself, don't. Did you think I was going to say lie? No. If you can lie to save yourself, that's where you draw the line. David had one of those moments in the last chapter where he couldn't do anything to save himself. He had to depend on the Lord, and the Lord had shown up in a miraculous way. He set all of his enemies to prophesying, and he delivered David in a wonderful way that would give David a tremendous testimony. So let that be the course you take. I'm going to stand firm on my faith. You know, if I fail right here in this spot, if this is what takes me down, so be it. It's been a good ride. But I'm going to wait on the Lord, and if he don't deliver me, I won't be delivered. But if he does, I'm going to have a story to tell. Verse 7. If he says, good, so this is the test for Saul, you know, if Saul notices that David's missing. If he says, good, you know, that would mean, well, okay, thanks for letting me know, Jonathan. Good for David. I'm happy that he gets to be with family for the holidays. All right. If he says good, it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that harm is determined by him. So did you get all that? If Saul is okay with David skipping this feast, then that would mean that Saul has cooled off. Saul has backed off. And he's no longer seeking to kill David. But if Saul gets angry that David hasn't shown up to David, that only means one thing. That means Saul was looking for David to show up because Saul's still trying to get his hands on David. And he would see that feast as an opportunity to grab David and put him to death. So that's the sign for David. If he's angry, I'm not there. Yeah, that means he was hoping to kill me during this holiday, during this feast. Verse 8. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. So he's referencing the friendship pact that they made there in chapter 18. And we get a bit of new information here, something we did not know from chapter 18. It wasn't a twofold cord. What do I mean by that? I'm referencing a Bible verse, right? Their friendship was a threefold cord, which is not easily broken. It wasn't just David and Jonathan. It was David, Jonathan, and the Lord. And that's the way our Christian friendships, our Christian relationships should be as well, especially our marriages. You know, those are like one of the topical looks that we give when we're when we're giving counseling to new folks that are about to get married or newlyweds, oftentimes we'll quote that passage in weddings because that's an important one. Get God in all of your Christian relationships. I realize you can't always do that in the friendships that you have with non-Christians, but you should do that in all of your Christian relationships. Get the Lord in that relationship. If the Lord's not in that relationship, then it is far more likely that the cord of that friendship is going to break at some point. But if the Lord's in that, he's going to keep it from breaking. Reading on. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself. Just kill me now, Jonathan. I'd rather you kill me than your dad. Just a matter of principle. I'd rather be killed by a friend than an enemy. For why should you bring me to your father? He's still trying to get Jonathan to let him go. Because, again, Jonathan is on the hook for this, and he is currently torn between whether he should believe his father or David. Verse 9, and Jonathan said, far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Verse 10, then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you roughly? Verse 11, and Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out into the field. So they both went out into the field. They're going to pick a spot here. Verse 12. And Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father, when I have had a little chat with dad, and I've been able to pick his brain and find out where he really truly stands on this, about this time tomorrow, or the third day, the day after the feast of the new moon, behold, if he is well disposed, if he is of a favorable disposition toward you, David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? Verse 13. But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan, and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away. So he's saying, David, I'm going to make sure I let you know either way. And he does this under oath. He's taken another oath, and that oath has included a curse. So he's pretty serious about this. Reading on, that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you as he was with my father. Verse 14, if I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. Verse 15, and do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. Verse 16, and Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. I love those verses we just read there. First off, that is a wonderful confession from Jonathan that regardless of how all of this goes down, Jonathan is 100% convinced that God has chosen David to be the successor to Saul. He has chosen David to be the next king over Israel. And Jonathan is completely fine with that. Why is that a big deal? Why do I emphasize that? Because Jonathan is the son of Saul. And Jonathan should be in line to be the king. This should be Jonathan's position. We've talked about that before. Jonathan should be really angry, humanly speaking, about God's choice to put David as the next king. You remember how this went. First of all, Saul fooled around and lost the throne for himself, and then didn't know better than to quit while he was ahead. And he continued to fool around until he lost the throne, not just for himself, but for his entire lineage as well. He lost it for the whole family. That would no longer be a royal line. So you would think Jonathan would not be this favorably disposition toward David. You would think he would not be supporting David. You would think there would at least be some dis-ease there in that relationship because this should be Jonathan's position. But though Jonathan is all aware of that, he doesn't care about any of that. It doesn't matter to him. Jonathan only cares about the Lord's will for the nation of Israel. He is more concerned about the good of the kingdom of God than he is for his own good or for his own vocation, his own career, his own success. I love that about this guy. As we've been sharing in our studies, Jonathan is a very high character type of guy. He really loves the Lord, and he loves David enough as a friend to support David in David's eventual promotion, even though it is at the sake of his own loss here. I wonder what would the global church look like if we all had this same character related to, you know, interpersonal relationships in the church. What if not only were we okay with brothers and sisters being selected over us for stuff we really wanted, but what if we were actually like really excited for them and supported them with all of our hearts? What if we didn't let jealousies creep into the church, but instead just loved like David and Jonathan loved in this friendship? What would a church like that look like? And this is where you're supposed to raise your hand and say, I know, Anchored Fellowship. That'd be a good answer. I'd take it. I'd accept that. This church really does excel at that, putting brothers and sisters above, you know, their own good, their own well-being. It's a very selfless church. I'm very thankful for that. I commend you for that. But if you don't yet reflect that standard, that Anchored Fellowship Bible standard for character among the church, let me read you three very convicting and very challenging verses. You should put some thought to these. You should put some prayer to these. I think they're important. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Romans chapter 12, verse 10. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 24. Let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbor. That's all church context stuff. That's all directly relating to interpersonal relationships within the church. And after that great confession from Jonathan, we get this humble request from Jonathan that David would have mercy on him and the rest of his family, Saul excluded, of course. And we know that Israel has no past experience on this, but this is their first king, so they wouldn't know how this would ordinarily go. But ordinarily, when it came to other nations that had kings, it was very common for a new king to come in, scrutinize the previous administration, and then remove anyone that he felt was a threat to the new administration. Anyone that he felt was a threat to the throne, they would be removed. Either they would be, kicked out of the kingdom, or they would be thrown in prison, or worst of all, they might be even executed. That was something that other nations did. It's something we see to a lesser degree in modern politics. I realize it's not actual murder most of the time. Usually it's just the verbal attacks. Usually it's just tearing apart the previous administration folks as much as is possible. But that sort of thing happened for real. Like, it got physical and violent when there was an exchange or a change of kings and administrations. So Jonathan knows that God is going to wipe out anyone that fights against David. I love that. He knows that. There's no question in his mind about that. So he knows that if it's true about his father Saul, and Saul really is truly decided on killing David, he knows that that means the day is coming when his father is going down. The Lord is going to take him out. Because he believes that the Lord truly wants David in that position. That means to Jonathan that anyone that would resist, anyone that would fight against David, the Lord is going to take them out. And Jonathan wants to be able to say, I want you to know, don't blame me and the rest of the family for what my dad's doing. If he's really doing this, please don't take it out on us. We're different. We support you. We'll follow. So have mercy on the rest of the family. Verse 17. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. And again, we talked about that already a little bit here in this study. We've talked about it recently in other studies, but that really is the second most important commandment from the Lord. It comes right out of the Ten Commandments. If you break the Ten Commandments up into two categories, the first category is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second category is love your neighbor as yourself. That's told to us in the Old Testament. That's told to us by Jesus in the New Testament. So the love that Jonathan and David have for one another, no, it's not inappropriate in any way. That's actually the aim for fulfilling that half of the Ten Commandments. That's the aim for the godly person. And both of those are humanly impossible. We understand that, right? You would agree. It is humanly impossible to love the Lord with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. If you think you're going to be perfect at that, I mean, you can pick a start date and try to be perfect in loving the Lord, and you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it to the end. Even if you start now, even if we give you a late start, you're not going to make it to the end loving the Lord perfectly. You are absolutely, definitely, most certainly not going to be able to love all people as much as you love yourself. And if you try to tell me that you can or that you do, then you are lying to yourself. That is even more difficult than the first one, because it's easier to love the Lord because he's altogether lovely. It's more difficult to love people perfectly because there are a lot of people that are not very lovely. They are difficult to love. We're going to be imperfect at that. The only one that wasn't was the God-man himself, Jesus, divinity in our flesh. He was able to love God perfectly. He was able to love people perfectly. If we could do that, well, then he wouldn't have had to come to do it and then die for our inability to do it. But he did, because we can't do it. Are you confused? I think I just confused my own self. I think it made sense, though. We'll have to play it back in the future. So that is, nonetheless, that is the standard aim for the godly man or woman, the person seeking godliness in their life. Love God perfectly. Love people as much as you love yourself. Verse 18. Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed." That is, it's going to be conspicuous. Everyone is going to notice you are not sitting at your seat. You have a designated seat. You're a VIP among the staff. It's going to be felt that you are not there, because your seat will be empty. Verse 19. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was in hand, and remain beside the stone heap. So that Hebrew word for heap is ezel, and it means memorial stone. So this wasn't just like a bunch of random rocks put there by creation. This was a Jewish landmark. They put these memorial stones, they stacked these up for a reason. So he's looking for a specific place to set all of this up. Verse 20, and he said, this is Jonathan speaking, "I will shoot three arrows to the side of it as though I shot at a mark." In other words, he's going to do some fake target practicing. He's going to act like he's target practicing with his bow and arrow, and he's going to shoot it over toward where David is behind these memorial stones. And he's going to have an arrow fetcher with him. Verse 21. "And behold, I will send the boy," the arrow fetcher, "saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I say to the boy, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, take them,' then you, David, are to come. For as the Lord lives, it is safe for you, and there is no danger." Verse 22. "But if I say to the youth," the arrow fetcher, "'Look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for the Lord has sent you away. So that's a very creative sign for Jonathan to communicate what David needs to do. If he says to the arrow fetcher that the arrows are right beside you, that means, don't worry, David, Saul's on your side. You're all good. Come on back. But if he says to the arrow fetcher, oh, keep going way out there, that means, David, scram, skedaddle, vamoose, get out of here, get out of Dodge. Saul is definitely still trying to kill you. Of course, we know how this is going to go, don't we? I mean, yeah, we know. But Jonathan does not. Verse 23. And as for the matter of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. There's that threefold cord. Verse 24. So David hid himself in the field. And when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. Verse 25. The king sat on his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Verse 26. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him, for he is not clean. Surely he is not clean. So Saul gives him a pass the first day. David doesn't show up the first day, and he's like, okay, well, this makes sense. David's a soldier. It is very common for a soldier to come in contact with a dead body. Most of the time it's because it was a live body and that soldier made it a dead body. Either way, they've come into contact with a dead body. Now, there were a lot of ways that a Jewish male could become ceremonially unclean, but this would be the most common one for a soldier. And the way that it worked for coming into contact with a dead body is that you would be ceremonially unclean for that evening. And you would be fine the next day when you woke up. You would be ceremonially clean again. So if David came into contact with a dead body, yeah, he wouldn't be at the feast on the first day, but he'd be there on the second day. Saul's willing to wait him out because killing people, that's worth waiting a day for, apparently, for Saul. I wouldn't know, but it appears that's the case for Saul. Surely he is not clean. He'll be here tomorrow, verse 27, but on the second day, the day after the new moon, so this would be the first day of the month, David's place was empty. So day two now, and David still has not shown up. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Well, gee, I don't know. Saul, maybe it's because you've been trying to kill him. Maybe he has a little bit of sense in his brain, but verse 28, Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. You a little surprised by this? Jonathan's telling the lie that David told him to tell. He's telling the lie. But it is what it is. The Bible records accurate history. It won't condone a lie, but it'll record it. This isn't revisionist history. This is accurate. Verse 29, he said, let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. Now, I didn't read that from David. I suspect this is a bit of an ad lib here. He's trying to make, like, he's really trying to sell the lie. Oh, yeah, his brother really was pressuring him about this. Like, David, you got to be here. So, yeah, that's why David's not here. He's with his family. Reading on. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. And now we get to find out who's right about Saul, Jonathan, or David. Is Jonathan right? And Saul has turned into a great big lovable teddy bear all of a sudden. Or is David right? And is Saul still a raving lunatic, a madman bent on murdering David? Verse 30, then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. Uh-oh, you know what that means. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Whoa, wow. Can you believe he just said that? Now, understanding and interpreting Hebrew words and idioms can be challenging enough as it is, especially when it's a Hebrew curse word when it's Hebrew, foul language. And that's exactly what we have here. This is Hebrew foul language. I know it sounds like Saul just called his own wife a perverse and rebellious woman. But as we understand Hebrew foul language and its usage at the time, I don't think that's really what Saul was meaning to do there. What he's actually doing is telling Jonathan that he isn't acting like the son of his mother. He's basically saying, Jonathan, I'm not really sure if you're blood related. I'm not really sure that this is your mother. I'm thinking maybe you were born from some other woman, a perverse, rebellious woman. And, you know, it's really no different than the way people curse at each other today, not saved people. Not regenerated people, but unregenerated people. I mean, I've heard this stuff 1,000 times over where you'll have a guy with his wife and kid, and he'll call his own kid, and I would never use this outside of an instructional situation like this, but he would call his own kid a son of a bitch with his mother right there, his wife right there, and that means son of a dog. And I've seen this thousands of times, and the mother's sitting there and she don't care. She's unsaved too, and that's just what unsaved people do. They use foul language. It's totally acceptable. It's just what you say. No offense was taken at it, even though, you know, to us we'd be like, whoa, you really just disrespected your own wife there. Or in the way that someone would call someone, you know, like a father would call his own son a bastard, get mad at his son and call him a bastard. And the mom's right there and she don't care because they're all unsaved. And that's just the way they talk. In fact, it's tough for them to go 2 full sentences without using some kind of word like that. That's pretty foul. So it doesn't matter to them. And that's how it's being used here. I don't think his wife would actually take offense to this. I think that the point was saying you're not really acting like the son of your mother. And I think the CEV does a really good job of translating this for meaning. It reads like this, and I'll give you the whole verse here. This is 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 30 in the CEV. It says this, Saul was furious with Jonathan and yelled, "You're no son of mine, you traitor. I know you've chosen to be loyal to that son of Jesse. You should be ashamed of yourself. And your own mother should be ashamed that you were ever born." That is really a really good translation for meaning. That's kind of the gist of what was being said there. It's not accurate literally. The ESV is way more accurate literally, but it's accurate in giving us a dynamic equivalence of that and interpretation of that for meaning. It's helping us to see how the Hebrews use those kinds of words. And you heard that last line as well, "to the shame of your mother's nakedness." In the ESV, very literal, very good translation, just maybe not super clear to us in our understanding. That would be essentially saying to Jonathan, "Jonathan, you are shaming the moment that your mother conceived you. You're bringing shame to the moment of your birth." And regardless, we know it is extremely disrespectful to say "with his wife" there, and he did so in a public setting in front of his staff. And it gets even worse. This is a sacred holiday. This is a holy feast. And he's just cursed and said some pretty foul and disgusting things. But we would expect that from Saul at this point. He's been unhinged for a while. And that hinge is getting looser and looser as time passes along. Verse 31. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Jonathan, are you stupid? If David's alive, that's your throne too that he's taking. But if David's dead, you can succeed me as the follow-up king of Israel. The kingship, the crown, it can stay in this family, in this bloodline. Therefore, send and bring him to me. Help me capture him, Jonathan, for he shall surely die." Verse 32. "Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father, 'Why should he be put to death? What has he done?'" Now, Jonathan's already tried this. He thought it worked. It didn't work. He's trying it again. He's trying to talk his father down. And what can we say about Jonathan? He's a son that really cares for his father, as all sons and daughters should. And he's holding out hope. Jonathan means well, but Saul is well mean. And Even if he does talk him into it at this point, you know, even if Saul does say, oh, okay, Jonathan, you're wearing me down. You're right. He really didn't do anything wrong. I swear it again. I won't kill David. Even if he does that again, Jonathan, do not trust that man. Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. No. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, not going to do it again. That's how George W. Bush quoted it. All right, let's do it right this time. Fool me once, shame on me. Nope. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on Anchor Fellowship for making fun of me for not getting this right. I got it right that time. Good. So Jonathan's argument is good. You know, what has David done that demands his execution? Dad, you remember the thing called the Law of Moses? That's kind of important. We kind of live our lives by that here in Israel. Yeah, you remember that there's laws in place that you can't just go killing people. There is due process for folks. They have to go through proceedings before a judge. There has to be an official, legal, lawful order of execution for someone to be executed. Dad, you just can't do this. But Saul doesn't care about the law of the Lord. Saul doesn't care about the law of Moses. He doesn't care about right and wrong. Saul only cares about doing things his way. And church, hasn't that been the problem for Saul all along? Doesn't care to obey the Lord. He just wants to do things his way for his purposes. And that is why God rejected Saul from being king. And that is why God rejected Saul's entire line from the throne. Verse 33. But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. Yes, you read that right. This is Jonathan, his son, that he has just now tried to impale with a spear. Thrice he tried to spear David. Now he tries to spear his own son. Could someone please take the spear away from Saul? Please. Someone's going to get hurt. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. Yeah, I guess that's a bit of an understatement. Verse 34, and Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month. So no food the first day of the month, no food the second day of the month. And then on the third day of the month, he's going to go talk to David here. So the question, why was Jonathan on this hunger strike? Here's why. For he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. I mean, this really was horrible for Jonathan. Jonathan's such a great guy. And look at how his father humiliated him in public in front of the staff on a very special occasion like this. And then on top of that, trying to harpoon his own son. I bet that was like a mood killer for the rest of the celebration. Like, anyone else going to say a word? I'm not a peep. If he would try to harpoon his own son, I'm not going to say anything that would get him upset. Verse 35, in the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David, and with him a little boy, that's his arrow fetcher, verse 36. And he said to his boy, run and find the arrow that I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow behind him, verse 37. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, is not the arrow beyond you? It's way out there. Keep going, keep going. All right. You know what that means. He's really not talking to the arrow fetcher, is he? He knows David's listening. This is communicating his message to David, who's hiding behind the memorial stones with his fingers crossed and some prayers being said. But alas, verse 38, and Jonathan called after the boy, hurry, be quick. Do not stay. Again, talking to David. That's David's signal. David, get out of Dodge. Get out of Gibeah. Run for your life. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master, verse 39. But the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter, verse 40. And Jonathan gave his weapons to his boy and said to him, go and carry them to the city, verse 41. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from behind the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Verse 42, Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Now it is a little confusing here, because if Jonathan was just going to talk to David anyway, then what's with the whole elaborate sign, right, with the shooting arrows thing? The only thing I can figure here is that he expected to have an audience when this was taking place. He expected there to be prying eyes, so he came out with the intention of giving the signal. And maybe there were some prying eyes around as he's target practicing, but I would figure at some point he realizes, okay, there's no one around, and I can actually just go talk to David myself. And that's when he sends the arrow fetcher back home, and then he goes and talks to David in person. Now, as far as David and Jonathan kissing each other, I feel like I need to address that. There's nothing weird about that at all. All the Jewish men did that. It wasn't on the lips, it was on the cheeks. One on the right side, one on the left side. That still happens in some cultures. Still happens even, I believe, among the Orthodox Jews. No, it does not prove that David and Jonathan were homosexuals. They're just friends. That was a normal, accepted cultural thing. And you can read that, traces of that throughout the Bible, and see that consistently it was a very culturally Jewish thing to do. Esau kissed his brother Jacob in Genesis 33:4. Joseph kissed all his brothers in Genesis 45:15. Well, yeah, Arlen, but that's family kissing family. Okay, well, here's non-family kissing non-family. 1 Samuel 10:1. Samuel kissed Saul. And now we have David and Jonathan kissing each other in 1 Samuel chapter 20. Drop into the New Testament. We see Judas Iscariot kissing Jesus. I know, not a good example. I'm aware of that. But it does reflect a cultural thing that was taking place there. And then the apostles taught the New Testament church to greet each other with a kiss. And this was a very appropriate male-to-female culture, so it wasn't, you know, brothers kiss sisters, sisters kiss brothers. This was men kiss other men, other believers, other male believers. Ladies, greet the other Christian ladies with a kiss. So I'm going to read these verses to you. This is Romans 16:16, and then we're done. Greet one another with a holy kiss. See, that's the key word there, holy kiss. Not inappropriate kiss, not seductive kiss, holy kiss. All the churches of Christ greet you. 2 Corinthians 13:12, greet one another with a holy kiss. 1 Thessalonians 5:26, greet all the brothers with a holy kiss. Okay, Paul was really into this. Anyone else? Yeah, how about the Apostle Peter? 1 Peter 5:14, greet one another with the kiss of love. I think you should have been a little more specific. That's okay. Greet one another with the kiss of love. Peace to you all who are in Christ. Why did I read all those verses? It's simple, because we're going to bring that back starting tonight. Men, before you leave, make sure you get up here and get a holy kiss from your pastor. I want to show you how much I love you. On that note, I think we'll stop and pray. We definitely need it.